It'll take you right over there. Let's take a quick call. We got Anthony on line one. How you doing today, Anthony?
Yes, sir.
Can you turn your radio down, Anthony?
This past week, sir, my one oldest brother, he turned 60. So I had maybe a comment that he won't have to be working that long. And he says he's going to have to be working a lot longer because his company, I won't say the name on the air, but they went into his pension, went into a lot of people's pension a couple of years ago when they were having financial problems, and they just, you know, actually it was like they stole those employees' money.
Well,
they were going for financial problems, so they reached into their employees' pension funds and whatnot. And
we have seen that across this nation, Anthony, for the last 25-odd years.
Well, I know it's been going on, sir, but it's just the thing of it is it gets me when it was somebody like him that's had just about worked for that company since he got back from the service, and he's put all of his time into that, and then you just see it. I mean,
it's an absolute crime, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because I've just seen the look on his face. He's trying to, you know, step up for the big brother thing, but, you know, when he talks about it, I can see that it really, you know.
It's frustrating on so many levels because we've allowed our government, through our government, we've allowed these companies to steal from working people in this country. And, you know, the Enron was the big story, but Enron is happening all across this country to workers, where they're losing their pensions because the company decided, you know what, we're going to invest in our stock, so if we do well, you do well. And then they go and they mismanage themselves, they put themselves so deeply into hock that they know they're never going to get out, they pay the CEOs huge, enormous salaries and all these bizarre benefits, and then expect you and me, Anthony, to pick up the tab. You know, one of the things we should have done in this bank bailout is we should have made people like your brother whole. We should have said, you know, mortgagors, we're going to make sure that your mortgages are paid. Pensioners, you're going to make sure your dollars are in the bank first. Then we'll go bail out Wall Street. What do you think about that, Anthony?
That's what I was saying. There's got to be, you know, something that, well, with this new administration, there's got to be something that can be done because that's, to me, that's just legal theft. I mean, you know, it's legal theft. It's like, I'm stealing from you, sir. You know I'm stealing from you, but there's nothing you can do about it.
Except thank me for stealing from you, is basically what they're saying. You know, you just be lucky you have a job, is the other line I hear all the time, which is nonsense. Oh, be lucky you have a job.
They do that all the time when they do things to employees now. They're like, well, you should just be happy you have a job. That's their comeback if you say anything, you know. It's getting ridiculous because it's the employees that are really doing all the hard work. I mean,
when do you think people are going to have enough? When do you think average working people are going to have enough and start taking to the streets, Anthony?
That's what's going to have to happen because I know if they keep doing it to good workers like my brother, they're all going to get pretty, I mean, if it doesn't happen, they're all going to get pretty angry, and you don't know what's going to happen then because they're the ones that's doing all the hard work, and then they see their money getting stolen from them like that.
You know what bothers me, I got to tell you, Anthony, what bothers me is that we're seeing the simple-minded rhetoric of the right wing taking the front position. And as I just talked about with Kim Bobo, author of Wage Theft in America, you know, the Lou Dobbses of the world say, wow, it's those illegal immigrants. They try and throw it on those least able to defend themselves, when the reality is it's the corporations in this country, the multinational corporations, who have destroyed working conditions in this country, who have destroyed wages, who have destroyed health care, who have destroyed our benefit structure. They're the thieving, no-good crooks who have destroyed this country, not some poor worker who's trying to feed his family.
Well, I just wanted to say one more thing, sir. When I was a kid, I used to read this comic strip called There Ought to Be a Law. There ought to be a law against that.
I absolutely agree with you, Anthony. I appreciate the call. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely, there ought to be a law about it. In fact, there ought to be a law about a lot of the stuff that's going on. You look at some of these bonuses that have been given out. Look at AIG, for instance. They've been kept afloat by, you know, what, $170 billion of our tax dollars since September of 2008? That's about $1,500 from each one of us, from each household in this country. And what did they do? They handed out salaries in more than $500 million to their senior executives. You look at Bank of America. you know, failure at its face. And you've got Ken Lewis making millions of dollars at a time when the company is going broke. John Deere, their workers and pensioners have good reason to fret over their retirement. Deere is expected to earn 8.3% on its pension plan investments in 2009, but the worst stock market decline since 29 has that highly unlikely, jeopardizing the company's nearly $700 million pension surplus. Overall, the nation's pension fund lost roughly $1 trillion in assets. So just like he was saying, they're taking money away from retirees. They're stealing your pension money. Yet the CEO, his retirement income, the CEO of John Deere, is secure. His value of his pension increased $5.5 million in 2008. So while the value of the workers' pension went down, the CEO's went skyrocketing. He's got $22.5 million in his pension fund. Yeah, we're going to steal some worker's pension who's getting a couple hundred bucks a month. I mean, there are so many of these cases of just ridiculous bonuses and stock options and funeral arrangements and corporate physicals. I mean, CEO, you look at Walmart, for instance. Only 48% of their workers have health care, but yet the CEOs, all the CEOs, they get an annual senior executive physical, where they fly the doctor in, and the CEO doesn't even have to go to the doctor's office. That tells you what the difference in planets that we live on. The doctor actually just comes to their office and does the exam right there. It's amazing stuff. I mean, you look at the golden parachutes that have been out there. Tyson Foods CEO. They're laying people off like it's going out of style. He got a $14 million severance package. So the worker got, hey, well, there's the door. Don't come back. The CEO walks away with $14.5 million. You kidding me? SunTrust Bank, they received almost $5 billion in TARP money. Almost $5 billion. And they want shareholders to approve a mega giant $7.7 million stock option for their CEO. So they took $5 billion and they want the shareholders to agree a stock option of almost $8 million. Something wrong with that, don't you think? I think there's something seriously wrong with that. I mean, you look at Jack Welch, the guy who was the CEO of General Electric, and all the perks that he got, a secretary for life, use of the private jet, you know, all of these things. And their workers are being constantly cheated. You don't see something wrong there? You know, when John Edwards talked about two Americas, those are the two Americas. The Americas of you and me who are struggling to make ends meet. And then there are those folks, the very few, the very fortunate, who can afford to have doctors flown into their offices and who can afford private jets and private islands and gated communities. You know, when I talk about wealthy people, I'm not talking about a guy who's making a very good living for himself. I'm talking about these folks. This is where the real money is in this country, and we have not been taxing it for years. And the way the right wing has spun Obama's statement on taxes, that, oh, he's going to tax all people, all the, you know, if you make $250,000 or more, because, you know, there's so many of those walking around, if you make more than that, he's going to tax you. Well, yeah, he should. And I'm a firm believer that we should go back to the same tax policies that were a good Republican, Dwight Eisenhower. We're going to take a break. We're right back after this with Isaiah Poole, executive editor of OurFuture.org. We're right back.
You work all your life. What do you get? $10 richer.
Back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. At a late afternoon Rose Garden ceremony yesterday, President Obama signed the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act, or Credit Card Bill of Rights. He said cardholders and card companies need to act responsibly when it comes to taking on and managing debt. I've asked Isaiah Poole from the Campaign for America's Future to come and talk a little bit about this piece of legislation. Isaiah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you give me a broad overview? What is the credit card bill here about?
The credit card bill that President Obama signed this week would basically require the credit card companies to give people at least some advance warning, something like 60 days, if their rates are going to get jacked up. It will prohibit the credit card companies from engaging in practices such as using your payment to pay off low balances before you pay off high balances, even though the high balances may have been the ones that are rung up first, and therefore the ones you might want to pay off most quickly.
Right, the interest.
Exactly. The other thing that the bill does, it requires your payment to be credited as long as it comes in before 5 o'clock. So there's no more if your payment comes in at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it's considered late because it didn't come in at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I got nailed with that once.
Yes, and so there are a lot of things that the bill does that will curb some of the more egregious and some of the more annoying practices of the card companies.
Right. Let me ask you this. Good piece of legislation, bad piece of legislation, your thought?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Good or bad? Is it, in your opinion, good or bad?
I think it's overall good. But I think there are a couple of things that it misses. I think the biggest thing that the legislation misses is that the credit card companies still will have won't have a cap on the amount of interest that it can charge on a credit card. And that was a cap was something that Congress Senator Bernie Sanders was trying to Vermont was trying to get. There are a couple of other senators who are interested and some House members as well that wanted to see an actual interest rate cap. Keep in mind that the banks now are basically getting virtually free money to lend out for credit card purchases and for other uses. So when you are charged 12% on a credit card bill, credit card interest, keep in mind that the credit card company, that's almost all profit already. So why would the credit card companies need then to charge 18, 25, sometimes more than 30%? These kinds of rates are still going to exist out there for our customers.
Yeah, when I saw the piece of legislation, I thought they had put it at, they tried to pass a bill at 15%, which I thought was never going to pass because, you know, when they were debating the bankruptcy bill a couple years ago, Sanders put out a 30% cap, and they shot 30% down. I didn't see where 15 would pass either.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I think that's the proof that the banks still have a lot of sway in what Congress is willing to do. The banks lobbied hard against this credit card legislation. They knew that this was sort of they were working against a populist backlash, and so they recognized that they had to give up some things, but they didn't want to give up too much. And I think at the end of the day, from from as far as the banks are concerned, I think they've ended up with something that they could more or less live with.
Right. You know, because I looked at some of the things that the bill does talk about, and they're not huge, huge changes. This is minor change, in my opinion. The fact that if you're late, you have up to 60 days before they can jack your rates up. I think it's not a bad thing. If your payment, like you said, comes in a little bit late, they can't nail you with these outrageous fees, which some of the things some of the reports I've seen, the fees last year were like $10.4 billion, the credit card industry collected in fees and overdraft, which to me is amazing.
The fees were a major profit center for the banks, which is why they imposed. I mean, the irony of all of this is that the credit card industry became an industry that depended on these fees and these tactics. And actually, I think what this will do is like move the industry back toward what its original business model was, which is, you know, serving customers who need credit for a limited amount of time. And it may be that we're not going to see some of these 1.9% teaser rates as much as we did.
Right.
We probably aren't going to have people who are high credit risk inundated with credit card solicitations. But, you know, the argument is that, you know, if you're a high-risk credit person, you shouldn't be inundated with credit card offers anyway.
Exactly. And that was going to be my next question. One of the things that they're saying is that this is going to make getting a credit card more difficult. And my response to that is, shouldn't it be more difficult to get a credit card?
Number one, I think that is actually an empty threat. You know, no business worth its salt is going to turn down a good customer. So I think some of that is empty threat. What I am concerned about is this. There is a level the credit card companies do have enough power to sort of get customers angry enough to have them push Congress to roll back some of this stuff. Not that they need to do that in order to make a profit, but they just might decide, hey, you know, if we can get some grassroots backlash in our favor, then we can take that to Congress.
Yeah, if we can
and
hire.
I think that's what a lot of this is about.
If we can hire some grassroots, agitators, we can maybe work that. Okay, I get it. But here's my point. When I was 18 a number of years ago, I got my first credit card, $500 limit.
Mm-hmm.
And as I used it and as I was a responsible customer, they increased my level gradually. And I'm talking very gradually. I know an 18-year-old right now who's got a credit card with a $5,000 limit on it, doesn't even have a job. That, to me, is irresponsible on the credit card industry's side.
I think that's absolutely right. Now, and we've all seen the credit card solicitations on college campuses. Now, you know, but that sort of points to a bigger problem, which is, you know, maybe if we have sending kids to college and they're needing credit cards with $5,000 credit limits, maybe there's something wrong with the way that we're paying for college. And maybe we need to attack that issue rather than sending kids to college, forcing them to run up debts. And I just saw a report today which said that, you know, there are kids graduating from college with $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 worth of bills that they got to pay off. Why don't we attack that problem?
I'm all in favor of that. In fact, I think the president has proposed taking student loans away from private banks and doing it through the government, which I think is a great idea.
I think that would be a much better approach than to saddling, you know, throwing kids credit cards and then having them run a, you know, $5,000 or more debt on those credit cards. I do have a little bit of a concern. I mean, I was 18 years old once. And, yeah, wouldn't I like to be able to get a credit card without a guardian signature? Absolutely. I think there may be some kids who will have a little bit of a hard time doing this. There are some kids who won't like it. But I think overall that this is this moves us in the correct direction.
I absolutely agree. Because I got to tell you, when I was 18, if you'd have given me a card with $5,000 on it, I would have been like Michael Steele, drinking and partying my behind off.
That's true. What I think the bottom line of all of this, as I said before, is that there was a big question, really, with the mortgage bill, when the mortgage cramdown bill, the bill that would have allowed bankruptcy judges to roll back principal and interest on mortgages if when there was a bankruptcy. When that bill was defeated in the Senate, it was Chuck Schumer who said that the banks owned this place. And there was a moment of decision whether the banks were going to continue to have their way with Congress or whether there was going to be some pushback. The good thing about the credit card bill is that we do see some pushback, that the banks don't get to write the legislation all by themselves.
Right. Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I think it should have, this piece of legislation, honestly and truthfully, should have gone further to protect consumers and, in my opinion, to tighten credit a bit, because I don't think that we should. What was it, 800 and some million credit cards issued last year in the country? There's only 300 million people in the country. Yeah, that's how many there were. There were almost, I think it was almost 800 million credit cards issued in this country last year. That's too much.
I've got about 7 or 8 in my wallet. I've never added up all my credit lines, but I guess if I did add up all of my credit lines on all my credit cards, it's probably about $100,000 credit line, which is a little bit scary, actually.
No, that's a lot of bit scary that there's that much unsecured credit out there that, really, honestly, and truthfully, you and I as taxpayers are probably, inevitably, are going to be responsible for if you were to turn irresponsible.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The other thing that I think we need to get at is the whole banking industry works. I live in a community which is it's a mixed income community. They're mostly working class families. We're fortunate enough to have a couple of decent banks in the neighborhood, but if this neighborhood just had a few dollars less average income, those banks would be gone, and what would be in their place would be payday loan places and these places where you take your car title in and get cash. You have the check cashing joints. Here in the District of Columbia, we had to write some very tough legislation to curb a lot of this because these are the places where people were getting loans at an effective interest rate of 100 or 200%.
Yeah, basically legalized loan sharking.
Oh, absolutely. And all this is stuff that is being outlawed piece by piece at a local level, and we really need to have what I think is going to need to happen is actually a national campaign that talks about usury, that talks about loan sharking, and talks about reforming the financial industry so that everyone has access to basic banking services in a non-discriminatory fashion.
Right. Let me ask you this, Isaiah. We got about 2 minutes left. I see all of these credit cards, and I've been talking about this for a while. I see all of these credit cards out there. To me, these credit cards have replaced what wage increases used to be. The raises you got at work that we used to get 30 years ago, those are now gone. What we've been given are credit cards.
You hit the nail on the head, and what we really need to talk about is having a society in which people can get the kinds of jobs that earn them a living wage, and so that they can manage their money and they can actually save. Because if you look, the savings rate has until very recently had been way down. People were running like engines in the red zone, with the needle in the red zone in terms of their finances.
And I blame that not on an irresponsibility across the board. I mean, there are some irresponsible folks out there. But I blame that mostly on the fact that wages have not kept up with productivity, wages have not kept up with inflation, and families, hey, you got to pay the bills, you got to keep the lights on, kids need school clothes, and you've been given this magic card that's going to get you all those things.
What's even worse is that during this recession and that wages have gone down, people have taken pay cuts in order to keep their jobs. And I'm scared to hear what the average hourly wage is going to be next month when the Bureau of Labor Statistics does its next set of unemployment figures. Because I think we're going to get a little bit of a shock about where wages are going.
And what bothers me is we don't see CEOs taking a pay cut. Maybe a little bit, but they're still making their millions.
Absolutely. And so the credit card piece fits into a much larger picture of what the country needs to do about wages, about enabling families to earn enough money to make a decent living, to take care of their families, to take care of their expenses.
All right. Isaiah Poole, executive editor of OurFuture.org, of course, the website, OurFuture.org. Isaiah, always great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you as well. You're doing great work.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a break. We're right back after this. 1-877-960-0960. One of these stories, only in America would you find something like this. A Florida prison. Officials there are apologizing for using 50,000-volt stun guns on children during their Take Your Son and Daughters to Work Day. State correction head Walter McNeil said that 43 children were stunned at three separate prisons, most with their parents' consent, which I got to tell you, you got to question that. Nevertheless, McNeil said, quote, "I can't imagine what these officers were thinking to administer this device to children." I can't imagine what they were thinking. Why in God's name would you zap your children with 50,000 volts of electricity? Just for giggles, I guess. You know, here's what mommy and daddy does for a living, huh? There you go, Junior. Here's a shot in the... Jeez, oh, man. Anyway, this week in the L.A. Times, the people who were opposed to a worker's right to choose, and listen, folks, these are the same people who are responsible for the wage theft in this country. They're the same people who are responsible for credit cards being flooding our society. These are the same folks. You look at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. This is according to the L.A. Times article. Chamber of Commerce earmarked $20 million in 2008-2009 for a grassroots effort. I guess they're buying their grassroots. Anyway, to defeat the Employee Free Choice Act, concentrating on swing states whose lawmakers are considering swinging votes on the issue. This sum does not include the $35 million on election-related spending during the 2008 campaign. So you're looking at $55 million they're spending, the Chamber of Commerce, to really deny workers the right to choose. Here's another group, and I'm sure you've heard of some of these. The Coalition for a Democratic Workplace. It was formed by the Chamber of Commerce, as well as the National Association of Manufacturers, Contractors, and other corporate groups who oppose the Employee Free Choice Act, backed by more than 500 businesses and conservative groups, including the Retail Industry Leader Association, which represents Walmart and the other big box retailers, as well as the American Hotel and Lodging Association. So all of these low-paid jobs, all these folks who they know that once the Employee Free Choice Act is passed, their workers are going to be flocking to unions, saying, you know what, we'd like a raise. We've been working for sub subpar wages for the last 30 years. We'd like a couple of bucks. Another group that the LA Times points out, Americans for Prosperity, an alliance of business and ideological organizations and individuals. It provides advertising and on-the-ground organizing in Virginia, Arkansas, North Carolina, and right here in Pennsylvania. The organization was founded by David Koch, a conservative philanthropist who partly controls Koch Industries, one of the world's largest privately held oil and gas companies. No lack of funding there. Another group, the Workforce Fairness Institute. Don't you just love these Orwellian names, Workforce Fairness Institute? They provide publicity and grassroots organizing and advertising across the country in opposition to the Employee Free Choice Act. It is staffed by Republican campaign veterans, including media advisor Mark McKinnon, attorney Barbara Comstock, and strategist Katie Packer. The organization won't release its budget or the sources of its funding, but the industry newsletter credits the Food Marketing Institute with having raised millions of dollars for the organization. Again, these fast food places, you know, they don't want the Employee Free Choice passed either, because they're going to have to pay their workers more money. Our good friend Rick Berman over at the Center for Union Facts, another one of these groups out there, founded by Washington lobbyist, our friend Rick Berman. This organization has run advertising in key markets, challenged labor allies to public debates, and distributed information about unions, including salaries of top officials. Center for Union Facts, all that is a way to destroy unions. It's another one of those situations where their main focus is how do we make people hate their labor union? How do we divorce them even further from their union? And the last group that the LA Times article talks about is Save Our Secret Ballot. We saw them here. They brought Joe the Plumber in. They're a state-based organization seeking anti-card check ballot initiatives in 10 states, Pennsylvania being one of them. Its board of advisors, two very conservative former congressmen, Earl Istook, and, of course, our friend Pat Toomey. You remember Joe the Plumber came to town? They set up this booth. It was a voting booth. They wanted you to go in and cast your ballot, yet they wouldn't let anyone who was in favor of a union go and cast their ballot. It's kind of funny because that's exactly how the process is set up today. I mean, the employers aren't going to let you cast your ballot without them giving you a little re-education. I'm telling you, folks, this legislation has to pass. This is how we save the middle class. This is how we save work in this country. Make it pay again, so that we don't have to rely on credit cards to put food on the table. We don't have to borrow money from the banks to make sure our kids have clothes to wear to school. We should be able to get by on our wages. We're going to take a break. We're right back after this. 1-877-960-0960. Your thoughts, comments, question. We're right back.
Good morning.
The 1930s were a boom time for unionization efforts. With the passage of the National Industrial Recovery Act, which guaranteed a worker's right to organize, union campaigns were taking place across the country from Toledo to San Francisco. The steelworkers of Republic Steel watched with great hope that they may be able to achieve the same results for better pay and conditions as the ones won by the Steelworkers Organizing Committee in its bargaining with industry giant U.S. Steel. Could they attain the same deal from their employers? Led by a largely anti-union hardliners, little steel companies like Republic Steel proved to be much more difficult with which to bargain. The company was not willing to cede any control over workplace conditions to unionize and to steadfastly refuse to negotiate any contracts. The company was not willing to cede any control over workplace conditions to unions and steadfastly refused to negotiate any contracts. In response, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, now representing with the workers of Republic Steel, called a strike May 26, 1937, and forced a work stoppage. In response, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, now representing with the workers of Republic Steel, called a strike on May 22, 1937, and forced a work stoppage. Headquartered at a local Chicago tavern by the name of Santa Place, the workers of Republic Steel were committed to maintaining the picket lines in front of the Republic Mill, as well as holding public rallies in order to gain support for their demands. The local police, largely loyal to Republic Steel, met each demonstration with an increasing level of violence that caused the union to call for a protest march on Memorial Day, March 30, 1937. After some rallying speeches in front of their headquarters, the workers and their supporters, now numbering 1,500, marched across the town to the Republic Mill to demonstrate against the company and the police brutality. Waiting for them there was a group of 200 policemen ready for action. After some loud verbal exchanges and minor scuffles, an indiscriminate gunshot sounded, and the police, believing that they were under attack, began firing on the crowd. When the barrage of lead had finally stopped, 10 demonstrators were dead, and many on both sides were wounded. The Memorial Day massacre had ended. Today, on the site of Sam's Place, stands the Union Hall for the United Steelworkers of America, as well as a memorial for their 10 dead brothers who lost their lives that day in the tragic and needless events of Memorial Day 1937. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.thericksmithshow.com.
Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. A former top fundraiser for Governor Tom Ridge is admitting she stole $1.1 million from the company that hired her after she admitted stealing from the Ridge campaign. So she ripped off Ridge, and then she ripped off her employer. Lori Simmons pleaded guilty to wire fraud Wednesday. Prosecutor said the 44-year-old Lemoyne woman is likely to get 4 years in prison. The money she diverted while handling banking for a Harrisburg investment company funded lavish spending that included real estate in Aruba, gold and silver coins, and a $6,000 bicycles. $6,000 in bicycles. Federal prosecutors say the total loss was $1.1 million, while Simmons' lawyer says a full accounting hasn't been done. But says prosecutors' figures are in the ballpark. That's pretty much their way of saying, yeah, that's about right. Give or take. Simmons pleaded guilty in 2000 to the mail fraud and was ordered to repay Ridge and his campaign more than $93,000. So here's my question, and I thought about this a little bit. She ripped off Ridge's campaign. How did she get a job working for an investment company? How's that possible? Other than that, she's just a good Republican operative and they don't bother. She's one of them. And they just said, yeah, come on, you know, you learned your lesson. Here's a slap on the wrist. Don't do it again. $1.1 million. Nice. And she's going to get 4 years for it. That's, well, I don't know. Is 4 years worth $1.1 million? Because I doubt they're going to get their real estate back in Aruba or the gold coins or whatever else. Anyway, I think one of the things I talk about in this program office is our manufacturing. And China being the centerpiece of that manufacturing problem. Reuters reported this week that U.S. manufacturers, retailers are seeing China as more of a risk. They write U.S. manufacturers and retailers that get products or components from China are increasingly concerned about quality, intellectual property, and rising costs in China, and more are looking at alternate sites, according to this study published on Thursday. According to AMR Research Incorporated, 26% said China contributes the most risk to their supply chain, up from 21% just 3 months ago. Other Asian countries and the United States were seen as less risky during this quarterly survey. This group, this AMR, works on supply chain issues with companies like Boeing and Cisco and Intel, Safeway, Johnson & Johnson, the big companies. AMR survey shows more manufacturers are concerned about labor costs in China. So they're looking at the rising wages in China going, well, maybe it's not worth it. We're not getting cheap enough labor. Maybe we could move somewhere else. And I've been saying for a while that Africa's starting to look pretty promising for manufacturing because, you know, you got a lot of really cheap labor there. You could probably get them to work for half of what the Chinese are willing to work for. Anyway, this survey shows 51% cited product quality as a risk, up from 45% in the first quarter. Many of them are rethinking their China strategy. Samsung, sound system maker, Bose and Hewlett-Packard are among companies favoring their Asian countries. German toy maker Steiff said they will be shifting production back to Germany and Portugal after outsourcing a fifth of it to China. Concerns over intellectual property, that is up as well. Oh, thank you. I'm suffering a cold here today. Anyway, according to Reuters, Obama was in New Mexico. He raised the prospect that China and other nations could stop buying U.S. debt, saying the United States needed to tackle its deficits to avoid long-term economic damage. Let's take a quick break. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Show 1-877-960-0960. We'll give this another try. American manufacturers are saying that China has become more of a risk. This new AMR survey is showing that businesses are looking to China a little bit differently as more of a risk than a benefit. And the survey found that 59% of U.S. manufacturers are saying that China poses a risk to intellectual property. And, you know, you stop and you think about it. A lot of the things that you're seeing in the Walmarts of the world and the big box retailers are products that were reverse engineered. We started making toys over there with patents, of course, and the Chinese figured out how to reverse engineer that stuff. So then they started making it under a different name. And then they undercut their competitor, us. From their perspective, great idea. From ours, not so much. Anyway, Obama is saying, look, we can't continue down this path. We cannot continue having China buy up all of our debt. It's not going to be good for us. And if you've seen the reports this week that the U.S. could lose their AAA rating within the next couple of years from this borrowing, there is another problem. You know, every dollar we borrow, we've got to pay back, and we've got to pay that back with interest. And Obama understands that. In fact, he said that this week from New Mexico. He said, look, we have to pay interest on that debt, and that means we're mortgaging our children's future and more with more and more debt. China right now is the single largest holder of U.S. debt, owning about almost $1 trillion worth of our debt. That's a lot of money. And finally, our representatives are doing something, at least something about it. I've been saying for the longest time, we need to get tough with China. And we've got to enforce the laws that are currently on the books. We've got to figure out how to get them to stop manipulating their currency, making their exports that much cheaper. We cannot continue to buy their cheap goods when they're manipulating their currency, when they're, you know, it would be like, you know, having a football game where a referee sat down every time you got the ball, and the other team could do whatever they wanted. That's kind of where we're at with China right now. And Congress has unveiled a plan to retaliate against countries like China. The Currency Reform for Fair Trade Act, backed by both Republicans and Democrats, as well as business groups and major labor unions, it aims to use U.S. anti-dumping and countervailing duties to strike back at this currency manipulation. And this is call this what it is. This piece of legislation is targeted directly at China. Because, to be honest, we cannot compete in this environment. It's not possible. While their labor is so much cheaper than ours, while they're subsidizing all of their industries, while they're manipulating their currencies, and they're encouraging dumping, we can't compete with this. And there are several groups out there who are really pushing some of this stuff. And one of the things I wanted to talk about real quick is this concept of protectionism. You know, I hear this from my right-wing friends all the time. Well, we don't want to be protectionist. And I say, why not? I would like to protect my industries. I would like to protect my country. And you go down to the checklist of things that China does. They manipulate their currency. They keep our goods out with high tariffs and duties and fees. China owns or controls most of the major industry. They subsidize energy costs. They encourage intellectual piracy. They artificially drive exports with subsidies. And they support sale of goods at prices below market cost so that they can flood a market. This is what the government does. And yet, we keep talking about free trade. Well, we should have free trade with everyone because of the concept that we have of free trade, that everyone is like us. No, everyone is not like us. Everyone doesn't seem to be anti-government when it comes to business regulation. Most of the world, the majority of the countries, say, you know what? Any investment is good. The government's going to take it on, so much more, so much better. I mean, answer this. How can we compete? How can a U.S. firm compete when they've got health care costs, they've got pension costs, they've got all the legal framework, environmental laws, labor laws, all of that stuff? They've got to contend with all of that. Then they're competing against companies in a country where there are no labor laws, there are very few environmental laws, the government subsidizes them, provides a framework manipulating their currency where their products are considerably cheaper. How can you compete with that? And the answer is you cannot. The Chinese have been eating our lunch for the last several years, and we've been allowing them to do it. And this one piece of legislation, is this going to be it? No. But it's showing me that somebody's paying attention. Somebody's saying, you know what, we've had just about enough. And it's about time. I mean, how many more jobs do we have to lose? How much more of our manufacturing sector do we have to give up? Now, look, I hold no delusions that those jobs are coming back here, because we've set up a structure in this country where we keep allowing U.S. firms to seek cheaper labor costs, more exploitable environmental situations. And I see Africa as that next big place where we're going to start pouring money into, where American big business is going to start pouring money into, because they can get cheap, exploitable labor, because it comes down to profit. And until our government, and that means us, folks, it doesn't mean some politician in Washington, that means all of us, when we decide on election day to show up at the polls, instead of 17% of registered voters in this county, 17%, that is an absolute disgrace. That is an absolute disgrace. That means 1 out of 10 people showed up, because not everybody's registered, which is another disgrace. 17% of registered voters bothered to show up on Tuesday to vote for somebody. That is just an absolute disgrace. Or is it? I mean, I've talked to a few friends of mine who say, well, you know, it's no big thing. There was really nobody to vote for. There was really nothing to go to the polls for. So there's still people to choose from. And you allowed someone else to decide for you. Anyway, this week, the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, reached a deal with the Treasury Department and General Motors on changing its labor contract with the troubled automaker. One of the key obstacles that is needed to clear some more money for GM so that they can avoid bankruptcy. And also this week, President Obama announced new fuel standards, new CAFE standards. This will mark the very first time in the country that a national standard for all 50 states will be enacted. The standards kind of look like that of California's, and a stricter version. And I think that's a good thing. A couple of things you need to know. The new standards of the plan will be a single national standard for all cars, all light trucks. That's good for the industry, because they can make cars and trucks across this country that are not just for California or not just for one region, but for the entire country. The standards will be almost 40% cleaner, more fuel efficient by 2016 than it is today. Cars are required to get an average of 35.5 miles per gallon. The current standard is 25 miles per gallon. So that's a pretty big jump. The effect of these changes will be the same as removing 900 million metric tons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. It'll be the same as taking 177 million cars off the road. It'll be the same as shutting down 194 coal-fired power plants. And according to the Washington Post, the effect will also save us, as a nation, 1.8 billion barrels of oil over the lifetime of vehicles sold in the next 5 years. More oil than the United States imported from Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Libya, and Nigeria combined. Now, here's the thing. Now, here's the kicker. Cars are going to be a couple bucks more. You're going to pay about $1,300 more under the new standards. But they claim you're going to make that up within the first couple of years, because you're going to pump less gas. They're saying the average American driver will end up saving somewhere around $2,800 over the life of the car. That far outweighs the $1,300 that you would pay for the additional cost of the car. The new standards are backed by the car industry, which is why some people are kind of flipping out about it. But they are backed by the 10 companies plus the UAW, the Union for the Auto Workers. The car industry likes it because it's going to actually save them money. For the industry, it means a single standard rather than a federal rule plus, like I said, plus the variety of states. And it gives the automakers a bit more flexibility than under the California plan. The car companies are closer than you might think already. According to the new car models for this year, 32.6 miles per gallon are what they're they're working on right now. According to General Motors, for example, the car company says that in 2008, its car got an average of 29.7 miles, higher than the 27.5 requirement, and it's on track for trucks to get 23.5, higher than the 22.5 it had last year. So it's a step in the right direction. And I got to tell you, you go back to this pledge that Roger Hickey over at Our Future, the Campaign for American Future, is asking people to go out and buy a new car, an American-made car used that was built by UAW, union labor, as a way to get this economy moving again. And I agree. We've got to purchase products that were made in this country. And as I said earlier in the program, my wife and I went and bought a new washer and dryer. And finding one that was made in the U.S. was quite an obstacle. In fact, there was only one that met our needs that was made in the U.S. The rest of them seemed to be made in Korea or Mexico. And I got to tell you, that is not good. That is not good for workers in this country when the majority of products on the shelves are made somewhere else. And, you know, I just wish people would take more time and to look at where's the thing made? And ask questions. Because I think it would do so much for our economy. It would do so much for our country. And it would do so much for all of us. Anyway, tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking with Nancy Waugh. She's from the Pension Rights Center. We're going to be talking about pension structure in the country. And David Balto, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, he's going to be talking about the destruction of competition in the capitalist marketplace and how we restore trust in antitrust enforcement to protect workers, consumers, and corporations. So that ought to be an interesting discussion. And hopefully we'll get Bill George on the line tomorrow, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, to talk about the Employee Free Choice Act. Also, I'm going to talk about torture, this whole thing with Dick Cheney and especially with Jesse the Body Ventura. I love his quote that he could get Sean Hannity to say Barack Obama is the greatest president in history. And here it is. It's been 31 days and still no waterboarding. We're going to talk about that tomorrow and a whole bunch more. I think Jake will be back. He spent the day at the parade for Memorial Day out in the town he lives in and all of that. So good stuff. We will be back tomorrow right here noon to 2. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good weekend.
Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
and welcome geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Frank Snyder, recently elected secretary treasurer of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. He's going to be here talking about the 12th district run. Mark Critz won over there in the 12th congressional district, and the teabaggers are claiming victory, oddly enough, and we'll talk about that. In the second hour, Mike Morrell, executive director of Keystone Progress, is going to be here talking about, I can't believe it myself, to be honest with you, Tom Corbett subpoenaing records to try and find out who someone's Twitter account is. Is this the state of things to come under a Governor Corbett? We will find out. But I got to tell you, Jake, one of the biggest primaries that I can remember in a long time, in this area, 40% of the Republicans got out. About a third of the Democrats in this area took time to vote. Still pathetic, but better than the 13% off of the last off-year primary. And the truth of the matter is, and I gotta be honest, I think the Tea Party was really exposed for being the corporate scam it has always been. The mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media's construct really has, in my opinion, degenerated right before our eyes. It's completely disintegrated, gone. But there's still tons of money, tons and tons of money. So you bet they're going to try and keep pushing that up, keep that bottom dollar going to keep this T-Twizzler scam going on. And I ask, you know, show me just one victory, just one. Show me just one. And they're, oh, Scott Brown of Massachusetts. Oh, ho, ho. Don't think so. Martha Coakley probably ran the worst campaign in history, even worse than John McCain's. And McCain's was horrible. Picking Sarah Palin was probably the biggest political blunder in the history of society.
How do you really feel? Right?
But don't you know? You betcha. You betcha that was a bad decision. You betcha. And then they say, well, Robert Bennett in Utah. Oh, Robert Bennett, yes, we got him out. No, not quite. That was the Republican caucus that did that. And there were but a handful of T-twits there. Just a handful. Not enough to sway it one way or another. They just happened to be in the room watching. And then, oh, no, Florida. We won Florida. We got Crist out. I don't know. I think he read the polls and realized his party had gone plain nuts. And that the establishment was backing his opponent. So like Spectre, he was reading the leaves, realized that he was the odd man out, and the party had left him, dumped him for somebody else, and now the report of Republican voters have one crazy choice, Marco Rubio. Yes, the same Marco Rubio outplaying Marco Polo with the big dick, Cheney. So basically, Marco is another rube, just like the little shrub, just like W. And then he said, well, what about Rand Paul? What about Rand Paul? Yeah, Rand Paul, he beat the guy. He beat him. Look, if Rand Paul was Rand Geronimowitz or Ram Jones or Rand Smith or Rand anything but Paul, he would have been a guy standing on a street corner without a nickel in his pocket going, hey, I'm crazy, vote for me. And nobody would have. It's because he's Ron Paul's son. That's it. And, you know, the T-Twizzlers, I don't know if you've been listening to the crazy media lately, but the T-Twizzlers are out there saying, well, we're responsible for Arlen Specter going down. That's right. And Blanche Lincoln, too. We did it. Here's the thing. Teetotalers, you're about as responsible for any of those things as rain hitting the ground.
Don't forget Jersey. Governor Crist, they didn't do that either. The Democrat was in deep trouble. And that was expected.
But the end of this, it's all this media construct. So I ask the question, this whole movement, this whole supposed movement, Jake, this well-funded, corporate-controlled T-Twizzler movement, full of people out there with signs saying, smaller government, less spending, who are on unemployment. Supposed to be an anti-incumbent movement, right, Jake? Throw the bums out! How many bums have we thrown out? How much have you actually done? The truth of the matter is all the T-Twizzlers have done is move the Republican Party further to the right, and wow, big deal. Now, that's like taking credit for snow falling onto the ground and covering the ground.
And did you catch her spin on the Crits victory? They're saying, well, you know, it took a conservative to win that. Well, it took a conservative because it's a conservative district. I mean, why is that surprising?
Well, you got Rush Limbaugh saying, well, Mark Crits is Rush Limbaugh reincarnated. And a little bit later, we're going to talk with Frank Snyder from the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, who was on the ground there. We're going to find out exactly where Mark Crits stands on a bunch of these issues. But the reality in all this, for all the hoopla, for all the media hype, for all of the, oh, the T-Twizzlers are going to take over. Oh, we're going to throw all the bums out. They didn't do it. You look right here in Pennsylvania. There were 25 races in the Senate, half the Senate, 25. 50 potential races, right? 50 potential races. How many actual races were there for state Senate? Do you know?
No,
there were,
I don't.
There were five races out of 50. Five of the incumbents had challengers. Five challengers. And they were all Democrats. All five were Democrats. So where were the T-Twizzlers? We're going to take back the party. We're going to run candidates. We're going to get out there and do nothing. In the state house, 203 districts, Jake. Potential for, what, 406 races, right? Potential 406 races. Wild guess. How many Republicans do you think ran of the 203 districts across the state of Pennsylvania? How many Republicans stood up and said, I'm a T-Twizzler. I'm going to run. I'm going to be the next representative of district whatever. How many T-Twizzlers?
I'll go with the flow here and say zero.
No, there were 29 races out of 203 on the Republican side. And you know how many were on the Democratic side? You're going to love this. There were 29. So all of this talk about the T-Twizzler majority, we're going to take over. What'd you do? What did you do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And what's interesting to me is for all of this construct, for all of this money that's been spent on propping this imaginary movement up, on saying, well, you know, these handful of people, they're going to, well, maybe they'll pick up some trash in the park. I don't know. Maybe they'll do something. Who knows? Nothing was done. And you look at the one place where working people can say, you know what? We actually accomplished something. Harlan Specter's gone. And Blanche Lincoln, who nobody gave Bill Halter a shot. Nobody. Because Blanche was, you know, this hardcore incumbent. The T-Twizzlers didn't do this. People who were angry at her votes on health care, angry on her votes on the Employee Free Choice Act, those are the people who are going to be Miss Lincoln's demise.
At the very least, they've heard her. There's some pundits, I heard them say immediately after the results came made public, that Halter has a good shot.
And I got to tell you, I look at that race, and when we come back, I want to talk about something I talk about every election cycle, which is instant runoff voting. Because I think right here in this state, we could use it. I think it would have been a great thing. And I think it's a great thing for democracy. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around. Point in all of this. For all of this talk about, oh, we're going to take our party back, the people who didn't vote the party line were the Democratic Party members. Republicans seem to walk lockstep. I got this piece of paper in the Patriot News right there. You can see it on camera. We're streaming live at therickssmithshow.com if you want to see what's going on here in the studio. Right here, all of these people that the establishment of the Republican Party said, this is our edict. You shall vote our will. And the Republicans dutifully walked out and they pulled the single, yes, I'm a Republican, I'm voting lever, blah, blah. Whatever the party says, check. And they did that. The Democrats didn't. You know, they don't have this herder mentality. They don't take the edict from above and, you know, the ivory tower says, you shall vote for Arlen Specter, and they run out and they vote for Arlen Specter. They didn't do that. And Specter lost because Democratic voters said, you know what, the guy's really not a Democrat. Pretty simple. And I don't care what the party machine says. To me, he's not a Democrat. Don't care. Don't care whatsoever. So they saw the ad. Yep, Arlen's changing parties to save his own skin. Beaten soundly. But the Republicans, lockstep, right down the line. And the perfect race for this example, if you look here locally, Jake, the Cheryl DeLozier ran a primary challenger, Marge Stutsky. Well, I like Marge. I'm not quite sure what she was thinking on this, but she decided to change from a Democrat to a Republican. So now you look at Arlen goes from a Republican to a Democrat. He gets like 46% of the vote. You get Marge, who goes from a Democrat to a Republican. She got 13%. She got thumped. I have no idea why she would have put herself in that, but she got thumped in the worst possible way. And why is that? Well, there's a bunch of reasons. One, the Republicans are very ideological, very protective of that R. That R is very important. You've got to have the R. Don't care what your policies are. Don't care about anything as long as you have the R. Democrats a little more, where are the issues? What's important are the issues, not the D or R or I or I'd love to see some other letters behind someone's name, which is why I think instant runoff voting, Jake, is, in my opinion, one of the best things we can do for democracy in this country. And I look at several races that we had here in the state. You look at the governor's race. We didn't get a gubernatorial candidate on the Democratic side with 50% of the vote. I think that's bad. I think you have to have your person with 50% of the vote, plus one. That's how elections are won. You look at the lieutenant governor's race on both sides. Nobody got more than, I think the Democrat got 35 and the Republican got like 26. Sorry, not interested in that. The Republicans ran, I think it was like 5 or 6 candidates. 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. They ran nine candidates. What I say, okay, fine. You want to run 9 candidates? That's great. We want more people involved in this process. The Democrats ran 3. We want more people in this process. So you make your first choice. This is how the ballot would be set up, because there are other states around this country that do this.
as we try to move forward into some sort of more enlightened healthcare system. And if you go to the front page of SuzanneGordon.com, there is more writing about staffing ratios. A major research study has documented the direct connection between California's staffing ratios and reductions in patient deaths and complications. Real numbers. Nursing staff issues are held responsible for 50% of ventilator-related deaths, 42% of surgery-related deaths, 25% of transfusion errors, 19% of medicine errors, 14% of patient falls, and 14% of patient suicides. That's not to say the nursing was bad. That is to say that the nurses were overtaxed, overworked, and overextended. It is the staffing ratios, the staffing issues. And those are management issues. And in situations where hospitals are pursuing profit, guess what gets sacrificed in the name of maximizing those profits? So again, get it through your favorite bookseller. I, too, prefer independent booksellers, but get it anywhere. When chicken soup isn't enough, stories of nurses standing up for themselves, their patients, and their profession, edited by Suzanne Gordon, and you can also stop by SuzanneGordon.com and learn a lot more. Coming up, conversation, other stories, and more. We'll take a little break. On the way, Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen with the Green News Report. It's Tuesday. It must be time for Brad and Desi. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is The Horn. We'll be right back.
It's Tuesday, May 4th, 2010.
Water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink in Boston and Nashville. Storms take lives in the South. Plus,
every American affected by this spill should know this. Your government will do whatever it takes for as long as it takes to stop this crisis.
Slow motion economic and ecological disaster in the Gulf going from bad to worse.
Much worse. All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The cap and trade bill was strongly criticized by hardcore environmentalist wackos. So, what better way to head off more oil drilling, nuclear plants, than by blowing up a rig? I'm just noting the timing here.
And I'm just noting that you are a jackass, Rush Limbaugh. This is your Green News Report. Today's Green News Report is brought to you by Velvet Revolution's StopTheChamber.com, calling for the arrest of U.S. Chamber of Commerce Director and Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship, following the recent deaths of 29 miners in his company's West Virginia coal mine. Blankenship and Massey were cited thousands of times for safety violations and have so far escaped real accountability. Help VR see Blankenship and other U.S. Chamber of Commerce corporate criminals put behind bars. Sign on and support StopTheChamber.com today. All right, Desi Doyen, things are indeed going from bad to worse in the Gulf of Mexico. It's remarkable, as we were discussing over the weekend, we could be looking at what could indeed be the worst man-made ecological disaster in the history of the world here, perhaps shy of Chernobyl, perhaps even exceeding it.
Well, there is the possibility that it can get there unless BP finds a way to cap that oil well. But we'll get to that story in a moment. First, a couple of quick headlines. Another series of deadly storms in the South killed at least 29 people over the weekend, 18 of them in Tennessee, dropping nearly 2 feet of rain in 2 days in some areas. Downtown Nashville is now under 10 feet of water. The death toll is expected to rise as the waters begin to recede today.
That was half a year's water in a single weekend in Nashville. Rather extraordinary.
An order to boil all water has been lifted for 2 million people in the greater Boston area after a 10-foot water main ruptured on Saturday. The cause is under investigation. Stores were accused of price gouging as residents cleared store shelves of bottled water. And that's also going to cost the city later in dealing with the sudden jump in plastic water bottle waste. The fallout from the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico has some wide-ranging consequences. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger reversed his position on drilling off the coast of California yesterday.
I see on TV the birds drenched in oil, the fishermen out of work, the massive oil spill, the oil slick destroying our precious ecosystem. They would not happen here in California. And this is why I'm withdrawing my support for the Tea Ridge project.
The now canceled proposal would have used existing oil platforms already off the California coast to explore for more oil. The revenue was intended to fill a $100 million shortfall in the state park system budget.
I must say I'm happy to see somebody out there, some politician, responding to the direct effects of this oil spill. It is remarkable to me that the Obama administration, that the Democrats have not used what's going on down there, this disaster in the Gulf, to push for climate change and clean energy legislation now, the legislation that was supposed to be delivered last week. Where are the Democrats? Why aren't they taking advantage of what I hate to call it, but this opportunity to point out how important this legislation is?
This is where big nature is now confronting big oil.
That was Larry Schweiger of the National Wildlife Federation on the environmental impact of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It was 2 weeks ago today that the explosion occurred on the Deepwater Horizon rig, killing 11 workers before sinking 2 days later on Earth Day. This isn't just a slow-motion ecological disaster, but is also becoming an economic disaster, paralyzing a region that supplies 40% of the U.S. domestic seafood market and one of the most productive fisheries in the world. Officials say the economic fallout could get worse, and this is if, only if, the oil spill gets into the Mississippi River Delta, where it could disrupt shipping traffic, a main shipping artery for the entire country. The president has ordered a halt to all new offshore permits until a full investigation into the accident is completed. In the meantime, federal authorities have instituted a commercial and recreational fishing ban in the area of the spill for the next 10 days, citing concerns over safety.
BP is responsible for this leak. BP will be paying the bill.
That was President Obama on Sunday after touring the massive oil spill in the Gulf, reassuring residents of the coast who are most impacted by the spill that BP will pay the costs of cleanup. But there's a catch. Economic damages after the cleanup is paid for, this is liability for lost wages and lost business due to the spill, that is legally capped at only $75 million. A new bill has been introduced in Congress yesterday to amend the law to raise that liability cap to $10 billion.
But it's my understanding that law won't take effect until the next spill, the next ecological disaster. We've got a mess on our hands, folks, and I'll ask again, where the hell is Obama and the Democrats calling for clean energy legislation now? If not now, when? Read more about that at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
This is a public service announcement.
There's a new type of music program coming to the horn.
Got a letter from the government the other day. Opened it and read it. It said they were suckers.
They wanted me about a summer or whatever. Picture me buying the scam. I said never.
But I won't heed the battle call.
Music for liberals. Music for activists. Music with a social conscience.
Anything down K Street.
The People's Mixtape.
Johnny's dead, Mitch's gone, Kelly Hathaway was out on the list, and that goes on and on.
Coming soon to the Head On Radio Network.
Now, run out.
Cut your flag, gal won't get you into heaven anymore.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're Head On with Bob Kincaid.
Yeah, and in 19 minutes, we'll be into the third hour. And so these things happen. Oh, well. But anyway, welcome back to the program. That was a fascinating conversation. I'm really glad we had it. And so much to go into in what remains of the program, an hour and 19 minutes of it or so. So, you know, we will do our best to get to a jillion different things. Before I do go to the phones, just a quick update for you. You remember, what was it, Wednesday last, that we were talking about
the what was it called? The Restoration of Stephen Baldwin. Remember the Restoration of Stephen Baldwin? Yeah, I don't think I mentioned this. Because God knows they don't mention this at restorestephenbaldwin.com. What the... Stephen Baldwin's debts in his bankruptcy? Yeah, $2.3 million worth of debt in his bankruptcy. Where does it come from? Well, it comes from mortgages, several mortgages. It comes from tax bills that he didn't pay, and it comes from credit cards that he maxed out. This is all based on the book of Job, and I somehow don't seem to recall any passages in Job talking about Job being a tax cheat or having several mortgages or maxing out his credit cards and going deadbeat on them. I don't remember any of that. No, sorry, don't. And I saw another news story today saying that every penny of the money given by Faithful, will go straight to Stephen Baldwin. Isn't it beautiful? Whew. Wrong racket, Bob. Wrong racket. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Oh, my God, that Baldwin thing. I mean, I saw a poster of it. What in the world?
Man, that's some brass.
Why can't he just get that money off his family? I mean, it's just...
Oh, maybe because his family's sick of his...
Yeah, no doubt. But it's just to hear that bit you played with that, I don't know, that preacher, whoever it was, who was soliciting. God, it was gross.
Yeah, it didn't do me any good. I had to take a scalding hot shower when I was done.
I was like thinking about that conversation you had with, I'm sorry, I've forgotten her name.
Suzanne Gordon?
Yeah, I mean, I can't even wrap my head around the level of dedication to put up with what she was talking about. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'd be out the door in a minute.
You know, in the 12 hours, she made a great point. It's like, why do they need to work that shift? Just off the top, it's like they can't speak to anyone and they work 12. I mean, it's just sort of classic kind of woman's work, and you know what I mean? That
moment. Well, what's really frustrating about that, though, is that if you talk to a lot of folks in the nursing profession, they'll tell you they like those 3 12-hour days or actually 2 12-hour days and 1 16-hour day. And then they get 3 or 4 days off. They like that. But the human body is not set up for that.
Well, no, but I was just thinking about that. I mean, I've done a job for, like, short periods of time where I've worked 12-hour shifts. And trust me, after about 3 months of that, Bob, I don't care how many days off in a row you get. The first 2 days off, you're, like, in a daze.
Yeah, you're just getting well.
And by the time you recover, you have to go back to 12 hours. And so... the days off are not really quality. But, and then with nursing, like she said, you have to use a lot of brain power and physical stamina and compassion all mixed together. Oh, my God.
I know. It's, the reason it was done that way, nurses were convinced that that was good for them. Oh, look, you'll have 4 days off. By management, and management did it to get nurses off the floor. So, you know, this is all penny pinching in the name of profits or bottom lines or some CEO's salary.
Yeah, and there never seems to be enough of, you know what I mean, enough in the profession either, which is kind of it's intuitive hearing what the conditions are like. Good Lord, when she was talking about what young people have to, you know, I don't know, with that generation, I just don't see how...
And the crippling debt that goes with it?
Yeah, no, that was just a really eye-opening conversation, you know? It's like on the front lines, you know?
Yeah, and when you consider stuff like the infections that run through hospitals, and I've got a statistic here that just blew my doors off, Sandra. Nurses suffer more musculoskeletal injuries on the job. Musculoskeletal injuries on the job than workers in mining and construction.
Is that? Wow. I mean, yeah, I, I really, God, that's incredible statistic.
And yet people, well, I don't know why we don't have more nurses. Jesus, they ought to be making $100,000-$125,000 a year. But again, we can't talk about stuff like that because, well, you know.
Oh, no, no, no. The discussion about wages is why they're not lower. That is the only conversation going on.
Yes.
And it's just really disturbing.
Why are we paying them so much?
Right, and of course, what you're told when you broach it is, well, you know, the employer can just turn around and say they're going to, you know, fill in a blank country. And so it's just a continuous race to the bottom. But, you know, my hand goes up and says, how do you sustain demand in that environment? Crickets, hello?
Yeah.
Crickets. Because, really, how do you...
They've got high suicide rates. Nurses under 30 surveyed say, I'm quitting next year.
It should be more in the profession and less hours and obviously more control over their job site. I can't believe how constrained it is. Wow.
Well, look, you know, physicians, you know, we have set up medical practitioners, physicians, MDs. We have set them up as God Almighty.
Well, no, they need to be outsourced too. Sorry, if we're going to, I mean, I'm sick of hearing about the outsource being just for the bottom, and I'm being facetious, but, you know, my economic professor will have to worry about it.
Yeah, no kidding. Dig this one, Sandra. By the year 2020, 10 years from, or 9.5 years from now, you know, God willing, the crick don't rise, we're both still around for that one. By 2020, 65% of the population will be 65 or older, and it is predicted that we will be short 700,000 nurses to care for them. Now, how are you going to get them educated in 9 years?
Well, no. I mean, I'm still stuck on a year. Yeah, that's right up, rolling right on us.
Yeah, be here in a minute.
Oh, no. Well, I just thought the conversation was really an eye-opener and just really disturbing because, like you said, the demand is going up for health care.
Well, why does this seem to be, and you always hear this about nursing, why does this seem to be the one place where the law of supply and demand doesn't obtain? I mean, obviously there's high demand, low supply.
It's endless demand. I mean, it's just sort of, it's stunning. And what you're getting is where nurses are trained, guess what? More cuts. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, there's not just a nursing shortage, and I should have, because she's in the education realm, I didn't ask this question, but I think I know the answer. There's not just a nursing shortage. There's a nursing teacher shortage.
Yeah, oh, no, that's because at the university I'm at, that's like a, because it has a good nursing school, but that is a huge issue right now, is raising of the fees, you know, cutting classes, and then the professionals who teach it.
I think if I had one of those druthers situations where if the lights go out and everything and I have to quit doing this, I would be strongly tempted to go into, there's like an osteopath school about 2 hours from here.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be strongly tempted to do that, but then, you know, you turn me loose with one of those and I start feeling all Marcus Welby and the next thing, you know, I've run off to join the circus with Doctors Without Frontiers and I'm, you know, I mean, Nigeria somewhere, you know, trying to fend off dengue fever.
Well, no, I mean, the health industry is expanding, but what it's expanding into is what's scary. I mean, I'm still stuck on the gag order of, I mean, what in the world? That is just so,
Don't say anything that would demean the good reputation of the corporation.
Oh, no, it's just hideous. It makes me feel sick. Well, anyway, the other reason why I called was, I'm sorry, what's going on with, the administration? It's just so quiet. Why aren't they using this opportunity to say, oh, shoot, snap, and then start talking about the green economy? Isn't this the best time?
You know, there's a lot of places I wish they weren't so quiet. You know, what I started off railing about at the top of the program, I want everything that the Obama administration does fixing or trying to fix or trying to prevent these disasters or return from the disasters, whether it be the Gulf Coast or Nashville or whatever. I want it to come, I want them all to come with a little caveat. You know, do not remove this label under prosecution, under penalty of law, that says this is happening because we have a constitution that says provide for the general welfare, and we're providing for the general welfares, and you bagger assholes need to shut up. Because, you know, when Alabama says, oh, please invoke title whatever it is and federalize the National Guard so they're not on Alabama's tab for the mess that BP, Halliburton, and Horizon or whomever created, you know, that just makes me want to run screaming naked around the room. Oh, you want us to federalize the National Guard so Alabama doesn't have to pay for it. But that is a state that is chock-a-block with baggers and birthers and deathers. But suddenly you want some of that socialism money.
Well, I'm just sort of stunned at the sort of legal protection that these transnational corporations enjoy. Am I to understand that there's like a limit on what they can pay out for a disaster like this?
Yeah, I saw that not too long back. What? The top end is like $75 million for BP?
After the cleanup. But the thing is that, and there's some sort of general oil spill fund that the government runs. But, I mean, it's just stunning. This company should be dismantled and put to death.
Yes.
It should be done after this. I mean, do they even have a clue as how they're going to cap this? Are we looking at some sort of...
No, because what they've done is instead of capping, they have started drilling the relief well.
Well, yeah, because they don't want to cap it because they still want to get at that shit. Ain't that what's going on?
I think that's a part of it. Oh, well, I can't just leave it down there. But there's some stuff out there I read today that the well was... same story. It's whether it's Massey mining coal or somebody drilling oil. The regulations say you can do this, but we're having voluntary compliance month. You can only have one cupcake, and you know there's the oil executive with six on his plate. No, the thing was apparently it was approved for 19,000 feet, and instead they drilled to 25.
Oh, of course, yeah. No, I mean all of it is. But the thing is that that looks like something that will be decades before it's right, and then lost species forever, right? I mean, this is a huge catastrophe.
Yeah, it is. Meanwhile, Rick Goodhair Perry, governor of Texas, has officially blamed Almighty God.
You know, I saw that. It just is depressing. It really is. Isn't it starting to whip up east now, though?
It may. It may. If it gets picked up in the Gulf Stream, it goes east. It goes around the Florida Keys and up the East Coast.
Well, you know what? How about we mix in a Category 4? So that shit will be, you know, washed totally on land. I mean, the possibilities...
Well, it is hurricane season, Sandra.
That's what I'm saying. And so, you know, the possibilities are just... It's all a nightmare. And if it wasn't so serious, it would be just laughable that Obama was out on March 31st talking about expanding it. You know what I mean? I'm like, dude, is there a lesson learned here yet?
And yet, by the same token, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't feel comfortable saying anything more than, well, you know, we're not going to do this again until we're sure why we did it the first time.
Noah Arnold came out swinging.
Yeah, look at Arnold. I mean, that was, yeah.
That's because these idiots had lost their minds thinking about doing something off of Santa Barbara, and it's like, hello, freaks.
You know what drives me a little bit nuts, though, Sandra? I play at this from time to time, but it's only because I'm exposed to how these sickos think and the way what passes for their minds work. You know, it wasn't a week and a half ago that I said, hey, look, anybody want to take odds on, and this is before anything got said, before the first peep, anybody want to take odds on this turning into a conspiracy theory that the liberals done it? And bang, there it is. Brad and Desi played it during their Green News update. Rush Limbaugh out there saying the environmental wackos done it.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. I mean, it's just sort of, it's just stunning. I'm not too sure I'm understanding the spin, because them people down there looking at it, I don't think Rush's words are going to soothe that. I think he has to be done, right?
No, that's the thing, because it's those 20%ers. It's not the 3%ers, you know, that weirdo from Alabama. It's the 20%ers. Because 20% of the people in this country, Sandra, are dead-enders because they believe crazy crap. They believe insane things like the Obama administration deliberately let the well leak.
Oh, right. Oh, I mean, no, it's just so much BS and so absurd. But, I mean, so you're suggesting that the stuff is put out by these freaks and their followers lap it up. Is this what the worry is?
Like kittens on a dish of cream. I mean, look, maybe it's more than 20%. There's a poll out. And this, granted, it's not the same topic, but I think these things have a certain degree of transferability. New York Times CBS poll says, one, the public broadly agrees that the Arizona the police state law will result in racial profiling. Okay, they agree. But 51% say that the law itself is about right.
Oh, yeah, no.
And another 9% say it doesn't go far enough.
Right, no, that was another thing that I saw that really was just, I was just shaking my head thinking, this place is really, I think I was taking a nap and I thought, I got to get out of here. This is what crossed my mind before I drifted off. Because I saw that poll, too, and I'm just sort of like, wow. But on the other hand, can you please tell me why these attempted terrorist attacks are being treated as if something actually happened? Do you understand that, what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, you mean as opposed to we stopped this thing and therefore we're getting the job done?
Yeah, it just feels like the way it's going on, you would think that it actually blew, or that plane blew up in the sky during Christmas. You see what I mean? The way it's...
Yeah, it's not... Right, the Obama administration is not keeping us safe because they tried and failed, because the terrorists tried and failed.
Right.
Excuse me. For 8 years, we had to listen to George W. Bush kept us safe because the terrorists tried and succeeded.
Right. So, I mean, I just was sort of thinking about that, thinking, oh, my God, everything is so ass backwards. And, you know, the New York Times is just covered with this story nonstop. And it's like, okay, I understand it was, you know, kind of frightening or could have gone down. And they've caught people, right?
Caught dude, and this is kind of interesting, not on a plane to Iraq. Not on a plane to Saudi Arabia, certainly not on a plane to Pakistan. Dude was on a plane to Dubai.
Oh.
You know, George Bush's best friends. Maybe it's because Dubai and doofus both start with the same sound, duh. Because this guy, let's see, he didn't have his propane tanks open. And instead of having ammonium nitrate fertilizer, a la right-wing terrorist Timothy McVeigh, he had a bag of, you know, Scott's Turf Builder or whatever. Didn't even have the right fertilizer.
And there was a cigarette-lit ashtray. Were they planning on just letting that and thought it would catch the air or something? I was like, what? It was, you know, the cigarette had me going. I thought, oh, come on. And they're saying on NPR, oh, maybe they'll be able to get, you know, DNA evidence from that. And it's just like...
Yeah, because a little hunk of his lip hung on the filter tip of the cigarette.
Well, it was just sort of the breathless reporting, you know what I'm saying? And from NPR, so it's just, God knows what's happening on Fox. I can't drift much further than NPR, you see, these days. Fox, MSN, all of that. I'm just over it. I just listened to your show.
Well, bless your heart. You know, if nothing, we'll all go crazy together.
Oh, Lord. Listen, I'll let you go. I just, you know, wanted to check in.
All right. Take care, Sandra.
All right. Bye.
Bye now. And You know, I joke about the tattered purple robe with the frayed moon and stars on it. But after a while, you begin to feel a little bit special or something. But there's nothing special to it. This is, I've been listening to right-wing speak for longer than I can remember. I used to listen to it all the time, like I'd work weekends at the Gospel Voice. And there was always some right-wing preacher on that we had to put the little cassette in the cassette tape deck that was wired into the radio board and play. And you couldn't help but hear some of it. And that's how far back it goes, because that crap plays in places like the Deep South. On the other hand, however, I would like to point out to you, I got a little piece of audio here for you. The Heritage Foundation, you know, the one, the right wing so-called think tank, the stink tank that has more money than God Almighty himself. The Heritage Foundation hosted a national security conference featuring a guy who couldn't actually stay on the job, but had to bolt for a Britney Spears concert. Yes, House Minority Whip Eric Cantor of Virginia. And he took questions. And I want you to hear, I don't care about the answer. Actually, Eric Cantor did his dead level best to give something approaching a normal answer. But I want you to hear the guy, okay? I want you to hear the guy that asked the question.
I want to thank you for coming today. I realize this has become a great cause. And I thank you for your passion and your enthusiasm for this country. My question is, and this is something that I personally don't understand. If it's a naive question, then I apologize. But how, in light of what Obama has done,
Obama,
to leave us vulnerable, to cut defense spending, to make us vulnerable to our outside enemies, and to slight our allies, how... What would he have to do differently to be defined as a domestic enemy?
Now, Eric Cantor says, listen, let me respond very forthright to that. You know, no one thinks the president is a domestic enemy. Wrong, Eric Cantor, because dude there that asked the question very clearly does. And you'll notice that that was not some the moonshine-flavored redneck accent either. Obama? Mm-mm. No. That wasn't from south of the Mason-Dixie line. It's not like, you know, for all I harp on the east of Boga, Alabama, and you know, the right wing freaks down there, they do not have the franchise on it, not by any stretch of the imagination. That's what we would call what you heard. That's what we would call a potential homegrown terrorist. That up east Obama saying kind of guy. That's why, you know, that's why some of this isn't so easy. It's easy to talk about the nut jobs in places like the Deep South. My God, there's a Democrat named Gene Taylor, supposedly a Democrat named Gene Taylor from Mississippi, and this guy described the oil slick on the Gulf of Mexico from the blowout. The manifest negligence, the gross recklessness, the willful, wanton disregard for the proper running of that oil platform. He described it as chocolate milk. Mm-mm. It ain't always Republicans, and it ain't always Southerners. Nobody's ever going to accuse dude there at the Heritage Foundation from just getting done with his grits. No, no. No, no. It's a broader problem. That's what that 60% number means. 60% of the United States of America, according to a scientific survey, acknowledged that racial profiling will be an upshot of the police state immigration law in Arizona, but they're okay with it. They want racial profiling. And for a significant number of them, they would like for the racial profiling, like the guy at the Heritage Foundation, to start with that one in the White House. Gee, money. Let's see if I've got John Fox on the line. Do I have John Fox on the line?
Hey, how you going, Bob?
Hey, what's up, John?
Not much. Well, not much. Boy, that was.
Yeah, well, I mean, only if not. Yeah, only if not much means you.
Okay, coming from via the webcam mic here.
You're a little crispy crittery, but you know we'll get by.
Okay, I'll back off a bit. Is that better?
Yeah, some.
Okay. Anyway, big doings over the weekend, and as everyone knows, the website had been kind of buggy for a while. And, you know, you end up in these situations where you think, oh, I'll find this, and I'll fix that, and I'll find this, and I'll fix that. And you finally realize that something actually is inherently wrong with the engine, which we finally came to the decision that we had to pull it all down and rebuild from scratch, which is fine. And it's all going well. I'm really happy with the way things are going. However, what people need to know is that user accounts are not all restored yet. They will be restored over the next few days. This is part of the data problems that we were having, and the reasons are so lengthy I couldn't even possibly go into it. However, in the meantime, folks whose usernames aren't working at the moment, you can log in with your Facebook details. And once I get your Horn account restored, it will sync, as long as you use the same email address, it will sync your old data once we get that all restored in there with the Facebook. Don't worry about signing up for a new username on the Horn blog as of yet. And hopefully in the next few days, everything should be fully restored, but you should be able to get into the website with your Facebook details. Right now, we only are have a handful of our bloggers with access to things otherwise at the moment as we, you know, get things happening. But it's such a massive improvement from where we were just a week ago.
Without a doubt, true. And I think you probably sold yourself a little bit short, John, in terms of what it's actually meant on your end. This has been huge. There's no quick fix to this kind of stuff. But one of the nice things is, this is a credit to the people who, the listeners who make sure that we keep going. What we had been using with the Horn's webpage was, for all intents and purposes, freeware and free theming. And at your recommendation, we finally sort of bit the bullet and paid for a theme that has some support to it and some follow-up and some background so that you can actually solve problems when they come up as opposed to just sort of blindly trying to sort it out all by yourself.
Well, yeah, because, you know, in the modern world of these content management systems, pretty much it all comes down to whatever system you're using. What makes it yours is the skin on it and what you have in that skin. And, you know, that can get to be a really complex thing, and we have gone with some themes written by the folks at Woo Themes, which have been developing their framework for probably almost as long as WordPress has existed. And it's a really, really great framework. In fact, the theme that we were using on the previous site actually was one of Woo's free themes, but the problems were not because of Woo. The problems were, had more to stem from about a year or so ago when we had to move servers. Some of Ben's servers that have been online for so long hit end of life. And when we migrated, something went a bit weird in the data tables. And we've never been able to quite rectify it.
Yeah, that's that the complex technical term, went sideways.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I usually go went pear-shaped. So it came down to a situation. We've known this for a few months that it had to be a rebuild from scratch. There was no actual repairing. And so now, in piecemeal, I'm getting the data back up, the individual blogs that existed back up. The menuing is already so much clearer on this. In fact, I've gone and gotten all of the free Woo themes as well for our bloggers to choose from, just because the framework's really good. On the other one, since it was unsupported, all the hacking that I did to it to make it work with our social networking system, I did completely blind on my own, on a theme that I technically shouldn't have been able to do it on. And that was fine. It was other problems in the actual engine that were making everything very, very strange, where some things wouldn't work in Internet Explorer, but they work in every other browser. But hey, that's kind of a constant thing, even when it's written right. But we're getting there. We're getting there. And I think it's going to be a much more seamless user experience. Show posts from the show blogs will end up on the front page very easily, very readily. We'll get all the functionality. When we first tried to do the social networking thing, that's all really coming good now. And again, it's also one of those things, Bob, like you're talking, it's open source software, but even more than that, the whole social networking part of it was a development in progress with the community. And, sometimes when you're on the cutting edge, you fall off.
You get cut.
Yeah. So that's where we are. So folks can log in to comment and stuff via their Facebook details at the moment. Just be patient. At some stage, you log in, and suddenly you'll see all your old activity pop up in most cases. The forum hasn't been touched yet since it was kind of standing and running on its own. That should still be standing and running on its own. It will end up being tied in like it was always intended to into the rest of the site so that people can create groups and have group forums and some other things that were always in the works, but the broken engine got in the way.
Well, exactly, and having the thing up and fully functioning, as I mentioned at the top of the program, has a lot to do with wanting to put our best foot forward. We're hoping that a lot of people will see the page with the more the appearances that we're doing more and more out there. And this is a huge step, and I tell you, you have my personal thanks, and I'm quite certain the thanks of the Horn family for the time that this has taken you and the time it continues to take.
Well, sometimes with these things, Bob, the hardest thing is trying to actually just block out enough of a block of time to take something like this on. And as everyone who might try to listen to my program would know, I've been a bit all over the shop lately, and getting blocks of time has been difficult. But you and I had some discussions last week where we decided, Netroots Nation is coming up. We got to get it sorted. We got to get it back up and get our presence looking right. And so, you know, there we are. And I'm really happy with the way it's going. Things are still going to shift around. You know, the show blogs haven't even been themed yet, aside from yours, just a touch. And it's all kind of in a priority of as we get there. But, you know, if everybody can be patient, chat logins are always as they were. They're separate from the Horn blog system, and nothing about the chat room should have changed. You should be able to log in just as you did. If anybody has any issues with their logins, they can email me, John, J-O-N, at headonradionetwork.com. We're getting there, and I hope, you know.
And another thing worth mentioning, this is a big step forward on what eventually we hope to do with some more video related aspects to it.
Yeah, and we're looking into different ways to incorporate and archive video content, and you know that'll be coming down the pipe as well. Right now, it's really working on restoring all that data, whether I can get old images and media to actually restore on the main blog. That seems to be one of the major things that got totally screwed up in the old one. But that's where we are. There's going to be a lot more functionality. One of the things we're going to tie much more into Facebook than we ever did. There's some development stuff. Not right now, we just have the ability to log in via Facebook details. Down the pipe, your activities on your Horn blog or group can be ported to your Facebook page and some other things like that. That's all still in development with Andy Peetling over at Buddy Press. But it's looking really, really good. and this is one of those things, man, why I love open source so much. A lot of what we're using would not have happened at the rate that it's happened if it weren't for people that build stuff just because they want to see it be able to be done, not necessarily that they need to see a buck for it straight away. And that's one of the great things about the internet, and we got to try and take advantage of that as best we can, as you know.
We absolutely do, because there's a lot about what we do that's kind of got an open source flavor of its own to it.
Absolutely. So we're getting there. Nobody's locked out. That's one thing that I gotta put out there. You know, I've got a couple of emails. I can't get in. It's just kind of like right now the shop's not fully open because we're still taking inventory. Your keys will be restored. Your temporary keys or your Facebook details. But aside from that, Bob, hopefully over the next week we should be virtually all up and running, and then the additional stuff like the video contents and whatnot will come down the pipe as we work it in. And the last thing that I want to put up is just a totally shameless plug. Any of the Horn listeners that are in New South Wales here in Australia, and I know we have a few, the Kids of Swivelhead have a gig the 22nd of May, Saturday, at the Sandringham Hotel. If you're interested in getting tickets, we've got a 2-for-1 deal going. Go to swivelhead.com.au and you can buy your tickets in advance, and love to see some of the Horn listeners at the show. Like, I've already, you know, seen Angry and a couple of other people down there.
Oh, I think that would be very cool. And in fact, you have kindly provided me some audio to play you out. You know what that means, don't you?
The opening track from the Swivelhead album, Cannot Live Here. This is usually the set opener, and I love this song. I love this band, not just because they're my friends, but they're great players.
They are. They're intensely good. They're intensely proficient musicians, among other things. But see, I can't see a line like "Play Me Out" without. What does that mean? To play me out.
Oh, you going to have an O'Reilly moment, aren't you?
Well, you know, I mean, I think... We'll do it live. We'll do it live.
So, anyway, before I go, I know you've made this point a couple times on air. At the moment, my show is on temporary hiatus as we deal with some of these technical things. And as I figure out when I can do my show regularly, because, well, my work life has changed dramatically over the last couple of months. And so we're going to figure that all out. And I just really think it was unfair to my listeners to constantly be, you know, is he on? Is he not? Is he on? Is he not? So until we kind of get through all this technical brouhaha, and I kind of figure out where and when I can do it regularly, Foxed Up will be back as soon as we can.
Right. As soon as practicable.
Yes.
All right. Well, John, thanks a million, brother.
No worries, man. Well, have a great show. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you later.
All right. We'll talk to you soon, brother.
All right. Bye.
Bye now. And that is John Fox. What isn't John Fox to the horn? Chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, technical innovator, and show host that last on hiatus ever so briefly. But as John did mention, yes, we have a track to play him out. So we'll run this Cannot Live Here from Swivelhead. And, yeah, if you're down somewhere around New South Wales, go check him out. Right here. Only on America's listener-supported liberal voice, The Horn. We'll do it live. In a minute. There we go.
you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
The wind, you feel it fresh in your face. That wind can change the world, and that change begins in Appalachia. Go to coalriverwind.org. Coal companies bombing Appalachia must be stopped. You can do that. We can change America with the Coal River Wind Project. We can't do it without you. coalriverwind.org. Go there for yourself, for our future. coalriverwind.org.
Left in the program here this Tuesday night. Feels like my Monday, but I'm trying to get over it. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, or on your nickel, 304-658-3333, and we'll try to get some conversation in for the remainder of the program. A couple of quick emails before we go to the phones. Assuming there's still someone there. William writes in and he says, you know, one would think using common sense that these things alone, all the massive horrors just in the last few weeks alone, but these things would shock the people of the U.S. into a true state of reality where we would all work together for a goal so we could all live rather than allowing the insane wedge issues to keep us dumbed down and divided where we will never get out of this. Instead, we continue to create sacrifice for gain as a path to nowhere, and call it some sort of normal act. I know. And the reason for that, well, look, it's fairly simple. Look at the bagger and his, what does it take? What does it take before we can call Obama an enemy of the people? You know, that thinking doesn't come out of thin air. Not by a long shot, it doesn't. Neither does the incessant, already ginned up right-wing screech that Faisal Shahzad be denied his Miranda rights and just torture him instead. Of course, you know, we know where these things, they're ginned up inside the Republican right-wing think tank consortium, whether it's the American Enterprise Institute or the Heritage Foundation or any one of a number of these right-wing filth generators. And they are used to keep a scarable populace perpetually terrified, whether it be of Mexicans, so to speak, of environmentalist wackos, or that brown man in the White House. Ooh, scary stuff. On another note, got an email in from Diane, designer of the inimitable once-in-a-lifetime for the love of West Virginia prints. Still available, by the way. Your kind contribution of $75 with things kind of down on the website right now. Just shoot me an email, bobkincaid@gmail.com. and tell me or make your PayPal contribution and say, I want a print, $75, get you one. They are becoming scarcer and scarcer and scarcer. Diane was the designer and the creator of those lovely, lovely pieces, and she sent me a link a few minutes ago. And it is to a story that says, Brooklyn artists, this is a New York City-based story, Brooklyn artists barter for your next physical exam. Diane saying, not really sure how I feel about this, but it brings to mind a circular pattern. And basically, you know, bartering, upgrading from chickens to artists. Yeah. And you go and you read the news story and you find out that Woodhull Hospital in New York City, in Brooklyn, has a program whereby they trade for every hour of art, music, dance, or any other artistic service you give to Woodhull Hospital, you get 40 health credits toward medical care there. Each credit's worth $1, so 1 hour equals $40 worth of medical care. Wow. And yeah, I understand the impulse behind it, but I also understand Diane when she says that, you know, it looks a little like upgrading from chickens to artists, and that they're operating on the same barter plane of worth. But Diane does note it sort of brings to mind a circular pattern. A dancer gets hurt in practice and needs to get x-rays. So the dancer has to teach people how to dance for at least an hour to have a doctor look at her or him, only to be told the x-rays will cost 8 hours of extra dance classes, and she can't teach or he can't teach because of the injury in the first place and therefore have no bartering power. And Diane asks, then this is supposed to work just how again? Oh, God, wouldn't it be simpler if we just had universal single-payer health care that took care of dancers and dentists and everybody in between? Yeah. But our betters are apparently doing okay. News breaking from the New York Times that a Picasso that was executed by the master in less than a day, called Nu au Plateau des Sculpteurs, nude, green leaves, and sculpture, from March 1932, has just sold at auction at Christie's for $106.5 million. Mind-boggling. Just mind-boggling. To the phones we do go. Hey, welcome to the program.
How do you follow John Fox?
Indeed. What's up, dude?
Not much. I did want to mention, I don't know if you, did you mention what closed Friday? I thought the topic would come up during the, your subject with the nurse because it is relevant.
No.
St. Vincent's Hospital closed Friday.
For good?
Yep. 3,600 employees. Out.
Goodbye. Yeah.
Bye. They said they couldn't come up with the funds. I tend to think that's bullshit.
That
opened since the 1840s.
A New York City institution, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, wow. 160-year-old hospital in Greenwich Village.
Right.
So where do they go?
You know, they say they're going to...
Where do the ER cases go? Where do the
They use keywords like transfer and shift around and words to that usage. But to me, I don't care. There's going to be so many people who lose out on that just because someone couldn't properly fund the hospital. You could have got Goldman Sachs to fund it. That could have been part of their punishment.
Eileen Dunn, according to the Associated Press story, Eileen Dunn, a St. Vincent's nurse of 24 years,
yeah,
said, I have no job. I am unemployed. It's over. It's like a funeral inside. Most of us have been here for many years.
Yep. You see, but the problem, see, the problem is that it really does set, you, someone could have put together a fundraiser and helped save that hospital. It's a question of why didn't they that comes to mind. And the people of New York, a lot of the philanthropists probably knew for a long time that St. Vincent's was on its way out. And it again, I don't think you look at the buildings in New York that constantly remain open, the ones that get the bailouts, the ones that don't. I don't understand. It's the same conversation. It's like a 360 degrees of what we were talking about when I told you about that Philadelphia library.
Yeah, that's it. I was thinking about the very same thing, David. You know, but apparently, I mean, why didn't one of the big for-profit hospital chains the purchase it? I mean, I don't think. I mean, is there an argument to be made that in New York City there are too many outlets for health care?
Well, you know, here's the thing that I don't get. Any of those billionaires in New York who are constantly trying to pat themselves on the back, where the hell were they? You mean to tell me Warren Buffett couldn't raise the funds for that? Okay. You mean to tell me Bloomberg? It's a New York institution. You get the press. You get the publicity. It's a win-win situation. Yet there's a disconnect here.
I don't know. I don't have enough details I mean, was it in trouble in terms of services rendered? Was it rendering poor services? I mean, but no, it was fully staffed, wasn't it?
It was the hospital. See, here's the problem. The hospital was fully staffed. They were fine. It's just that, you know, when you come along a bump in the road.
You know what I got to ask is what's going on the property? Once they demolish it, what goes up? And therein, David, will lie your answer. And that's just, you know, my paranoid hillbilly response. You know what I need? What I need is a hardcore New Yorker to tell me why it closed.
Probably a financial firm.
Yeah, wouldn't it? Right?
Yeah, I mean,
well, you see, okay? So you see where my mind is going.
But again, I mean, I'm still kind of stunned at the fact that no one stepped up in the billionaire Wall Street sector who always try to pat themselves on the back. We saved the New York institution. Nope, they didn't do it. This hospital has been around since the Titanic.
Yeah, but you know, it's Greenwich Village, and you know what kind of people live in Greenwich Village, and
they would. I mean. I'm guessing if it was a different time period, would the results be different? I'm guessing it would be. Like if this happened in the 1970s or the 1960s.
Or I don't know. Had it faced financial difficulties and had to be hauled out of the fire before? I simply don't know.
I don't know. The other thing I wanted to briefly touch on was the whole New Orleans oil rig disaster.
Yeah.
But I wanted to mention to people that there's a great new show on HBO. Everyone should watch it. And Bob, I do mean you should watch it.
Well, not a prayer. Me no got no HBO.
Oh, don't worry, Bob. I got you on that one.
Oh, okay.
It's the show is called Tremé, and it's about a neighborhood in New Orleans, and it's from the creators of The Wire, and what makes it unique.
Oh, man, I've heard about this one. Yeah.
This is an impressive show. Just for starters.
You had to say Wire before I made the connection.
Yeah. Just for starters, I mean, you talk about who to expect for guests. I mean, they pack this with John Goodman does an amazing job. as a teacher on it. Amazing job. If he doesn't get an Emmy, there's something wrong. But, I mean, in one episode, I'll give you guys an idea. One episode, they have a studio session with Dr. John. Another episode, they have guest starring Alan Toussaint and Elvis Costello. So this is an idea of the musical guests that they put on every week. And great storylines. People who watch The Wire already know an amazing cast and really does a great service to New Orleans and does not try to sugarcoat it. And the great thing about it is the people who put it together understand this. Most of the media always tries to focus on New Orleans, a city that has fallen from grace. And that show doesn't do that. What this show does is this show shows you that it's still alive, that it still has its heartbeat, and it shows you the businesses that are trying to kickstart and get back into action.
Well, you know, David, by mentioning TV, you took me to a different place.
Right.
And I also sort of juxtaposed this over against the email that William sent a couple of minutes ago that I just read.
Right.
You want to know why we can't fix what's broken? I got an example of why right here. I get blast emails from publicity flacks from a TV show called Extra. I have never seen it.
Oh, God. I hate that show.
But Extra, I have to credit Extra with this, or I don't know. They'll send me they'll send the PR secret police after me and take me to Arizona or something.
Mm-hmm.
Please feel free to use the story below with a proper link and credit to Extra. Hills stars at odds over Montag's accusations. Extra's Lauren Sanchez sat down with the Hills stars, Brody Jenner, Audrina Partridge, and Kristen Cavallari, who responded to accusations that executive producer Adam DiViello had been inappropriate with Heidi Montag.
Wow.
Really? Really? And they're spending how much money to let people know this? And I just fell for it, but I did so as part of a larger point of who gives a... But you know what? You know what? You know who gives a...
Yeah.
A whole lot of people measured in millions, David.
I know.
Millions. I mean, these are some reasonably pleasant-looking human beings. I mean, we've got apparently Brody Jenner, and Audrina Partridge is certainly appealing to look at, and so is Kristen Cavallari.
I got one for you.
And so why do I care?
I got one to show you exactly. It's coming from a news organization. Michelle Obama sends out her first tweet. I looked at it and I was like, wait a minute. You know, usually these statements, they don't go into like detail. This one is like 10 paragraphs. And what was great about it was the comments section. Like, really? This is news? Obama sent out her first tweet.
Yeah, meanwhile, here's another one for you.
Yeah.
The New York Times put out a fair and balanced report on why the platform explosion disaster blowout might not be quite so bad. And Brad Friedman is breaking this, and he writes over at bradblog.com, in a May 3rd New York Times editorial, Drilling Disaster and Denial, Paul Krugman points to a Gallup poll which found Americans are now less worried about a series of environmental problems. And, Drilling Disaster and Denial is a brilliant, brilliant column. So the New York Times gets a news story out about the disaster, about the explosion. Only there's one problem. In the front page news analysis that the New York Times offers, David, guess what?
What's that?
They offer a scientific expert to help support the thesis that the Deepwater Horizon blowout was not unprecedented, nor is it yet among the worst oil accidents in history. That's their thesis. And so they go and find an expert to say that. The expert says, and the expert's name is Quentin R. Dokken, D-O-K-K-E-N, apparently no relation to the former metal band.
Yeah.
Quentin R. Dokken says, the sky is not falling. And they identify him as a marine biologist and executive director of the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, a conservation group in Corpus Christi, Texas. We've certainly stepped in a hole, and we're going to have to work ourselves out of it, but it isn't the end of the Gulf of Mexico. But guess, as Brad Friedman points out, guess what the New York Times doesn't do?
What's that?
They don't tell anybody that Mr. Dawkins' conservation group, the Gulf of Mexico Foundation, here's the punchline, is sponsored in large part by the offshore drilling industry.
You know,
I remember when they used to teach these classes called journalism ethics in school.
You know, I was reading some of the inside information on the oil rig disaster, and one of the things they said that really interested me and probably will interest some of the listeners is the fact of how much the culture of oil rig and engineer and knowing your education has changed so much. And basically, from what I was getting at, the details of what this guy who worked on one of these similar oil rigs, he said, the culture has changed so much that nobody reads manuals, nobody reads the books, and they take pride in
well,
it.
Well, the books are probably written by English as a second language offshore translators and God knows where. Wow, that was really mean of me, but, you know, I have an element of truth. And, you know, here's more fun.
Yeah.
Of the Gulf of Mexico Foundation's board of directors, 19 members have direct ties to the offshore drilling industry. Here's a hoot. One of the board of directors members is actually currently an executive at Transocean. Mm. And that's the company that owns Deepwater Horizon. Nah, we wouldn't want to disclose that to readers or nothing on the national paper of record or anything. Now, would we? Heck no. Hey, David, I got to roll along. Awful good to hear from you, though.
All right, before I go, everybody check out the show Treme on HBO.
And we spell that how?
Treme.
Good deal. Thanks, David.
All right, later.
Bye now. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Well, as far as St. Vincent's is concerned, they filed for bankruptcy last month, and they were like $1 billion in the hole.
And that's so quick. Why not restore St. Vincent's Hospital instead of restoring Stephen Baldwin?
Well, I totally agree with you, but
sorry,
I understand. I was totally floored by that, but the transfer of function will be from St. Vincent's to Bellevue.
Oh, because they're not overcrowded or anything.
No. And St. Vincent's, of course, is a Catholic-affiliated hospital. And I'm sure that there's got to be some connection between the church and the closing of that hospital. Plus two other factors. Number one, return on investment. And number two, real estate value.
Yeah, because when I said, what'll it be once it's not a hospital anymore, Lottie in the chat room immediately chimed in and said, condos. It'll be condos.
Oh, Trump Tower number 19 probably, right?
Yeah. Lottie said, usually hospitals close and condos go up. He said Winthrop Hospital was made directly into condos.
And I would assume that part of the city, you have a lot of ER things that come in there. And, of course, by federal law, hospitals, whether you have the money or not, have to treat ER. And, you know.
Yeah, they treat to the point of stability. They have to stabilize them, yeah.
Right. And that has a lot to do with it. But, you know, I had heard from friends in New York that that was going to happen. But I had hoped against hope until hope. Obviously, last Friday became hope abandoned. And, well, that's a very, very sad, sad thing. I mean, what's next, Sloan Kettering?
You gotta wonder. You really do, Jim.
Well, I had originally rung you up to remind you that it is National Public Servants Week.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, for federal, state, local, county, whatever, all the people who keep things running for us. And I was just going to say a few words about public servants. And
do please.
And what? Well, I just don't have any. I'm just kind of floored right now. I mean, I think I've said enough about public service on this program that I don't have to say any more other than without them, where the hell would we be? But, you know, what your last caller said about St. Vincent's, I mean, they have enough billionaires in that town to have more or less accommodated the needs of that hospital until they could stabilize it. But they didn't want to.
And you can almost hear the conversation over the hummingbird tongue canapes, can't you, Jim? Oh my God, do you realize the real estate value that that's sitting on? What we could do with that?
Well, I can guarantee you they did not do this without the consent of the Vatican and also the financial moguls who stand to gain from.
Yeah, well, you know, the Archdiocese of New York would have some say-so in it, would it not?
They would. But, you know, this is strangely enough. I had one good Roman Catholic tell me that the bishops, because of certain abortion practices or attitudes in the Catholic hospitals, that the bishops ought to just close them down.
I actually heard on NPR a couple of weeks back a discussion along those lines about the kerfuffle that has been started inside Roman Catholic healthcare facilities about how they square up what they refer to as the church's teaching. You know, they never say what the Bible says. The church's teaching.
Always the church's teaching and how they interpret things.
Yeah, versus what the law requires. And you know, and of course, you know what was done in Washington D.C. Catholic Charities in Washington D.C. took up, simply because gay people can get married in Washington D.C. They stopped offering health care to all spouses.
I brought that up earlier on this program, remember?
Yeah. And not only that, for the same reason, they threw some 70 or 80, I think, foster children off on other agencies.
Absolutely.
Can't beat it. You can't beat that following the Prince of Peace, can you?
Not the Prince of Peace, but the Papal Curia and the organization of the Catholic Church, and I guess they're going to probably have to take some of the money they get from that, if the Catholic Church is going to gain any money from it, to pay for some of these losses they sustained over the lawsuits over the years, and they're going to continue.
Yeah, brought about by rape.
Exactly. That really floored me.
Well, and that's what Lottie is saying in the chat room right now. St. Vincent's was sacrificed to pay for the fling with the altar boys. Now it makes sense.
Well, that's the way I perceive it, and I hate to look at things that way. I really do, but I don't know how else to look at it. Do you?
You're kind of hard-pressed to do otherwise, Jim.
Well, on that note, I'm going to leave you, and I wish you and your spouse a happy 17th anniversary, and I sent you an email to that effect. So you.
I saw it. Thank you very kindly, and I'll show it to Agnes.
Okay, you take care.
Take care, Jim. Bye now. And let's see if we can get one more caller in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Kevin from Seoul.
Hey, what's up, Kevin? Good morning.
I can tell you what this is. They're not even going to knock down the building. They're just going to gut it out and turn it into a condo.
Man, lots of money there.
They're doing it about my neighborhood in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Jewish Hospital, which was there, they turned it into a condo when they closed it down.
And the condos are probably about the size of a hospital room, aren't they?
Well, hey, you know, they're going to flip it. You know, classic flip this house scenario, but it's flip this house for billionaires.
Jeez. Yeah, I kind of wish I was still blissfully ignorant wondering why these things happen.
But, you know, they're not even going to knock down the building. They're going to gut it out, probably, and put in a few condos, put a health spa in there, you know.
Maybe a little internet cafe on the first floor.
Exactly. A couple of Starbucks on the ground floor, or Starbucks-like places, probably a pool and tennis court on top and a golf putting range.
Yeah, because Greenwich Village is, you know, nice real estate, huh?
Oh, Yeah, it's pretty hot now. No, banking house is going to go there, but the bankers will be living there.
Yeah. No kidding. Maybe some $15,000 shower curtains and solid gold-plated shower fixtures and a $30,000 umbrella stand. Sheesh.
Oh, yeah. I'm telling you, that's what they're going to do. I don't even think they're going to knock down the building.
Pro-anti in the chat room, Kevin, has a lovely thought. He said, tiled floors, free flesh-eating disease. Wonder how long it'll take them to get rid of that. Maybe some of it can stick around for some Wall Street bankers. Hey, why is my flesh melting?
Yeah.
And there'll be another Wall Street banker standing next to him from Goldman Sachs saying, "I'll go short that you're dead by tomorrow."
But you know what's so sad though? St. Vincent is not an attractive building. It's like one of these Logan's Run like monstrosities, you know. At least what they did around my way in Brooklyn Jewish, at least the hospital was an older building which had kind of character to it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But St. Vincent's just a big red square.
Brick?
Yeah, it's like, again, it's like...
Oh, well, then you said, well, this is made with original brick from the 19th century. It's vintage brick.
Yeah, it looks like something out of...
I mean, my God, this hospital treated survivors of the Titanic and cholera out. But when was the last New York City cholera outbreak? They were treated at St. Vincent's.
1800s, I think.
Oh, my God. Hey, Kevin, I hate to say it, but I gotta roll along, brother.
Okay, bro.
Good hearing from you. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Calling from South Korea, formerly of Brooklyn, that is Kevin. With a little more insight on why and how a St. Vincent's goes away. So that's the program. Thanks, everybody, for your patience dealing with the website. And thanks for your continued kindness helping us keep all of this going and on the air. Thanks to everybody who makes it go and makes it work. Thanks to Lottie, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne at Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. If you go there, there is a link to the competition for a scholarship for Netroots Nation. Click it, please. Between the Horn and the Malloy Truth Seekers, we should be able to get Matt into the upper ranks of the competitors. Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. Thanks to my head writer, David, in Tennessee. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
this. Monday, no it isn't. Tuesday night edition of The Horn. I have a feeling it's going to be confused like that all night and perhaps for the rest of the week. My apologies for my absence yesterday. Fact of the matter is, it was... Look, the right wing can talk about family values all at once, but they ain't got a lock on it. In fact, I think we can make an argument with a few stories tonight that they have an active dislock on it, the dysfunctional or whatever. But anyway, I was off with Ferg last night. Here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia, we have a tradition, an educational tradition. It goes back to 1929, I think it is. I think it is the oldest program of its sort in the country. And it's something called the Golden Horseshoe Program. It's for eighth graders. And eighth grade children all across West Virginia study their little butts off for a test of information relating to West Virginia history, culture, and geography. And very few win the coveted Golden Horseshoe Award. Knights and ladies of the Golden Horseshoe, in fact, they are. And Ferg was one of them. So he was asked to attend the County Board of Education meeting last night, and we did, where he and his other county Golden Horseshoe recipients were honored with mention. And then this Friday he gets knighted. That will not cause me to miss the show. This Friday he gets knighted in a ceremony featuring the governor, et cetera, down in Charleston. I'll be gone to that. It was a sweet moment. It really, really was. Now, me having been gone last night is a reminder that I need to mention to you that there will be some scheduling weirdness coming in the next week or two. Let's see. Next Monday and Tuesday, I will not be here. I will not be behind the microphone Monday or Tuesday of next week. I will be off in the wilds of Kentucky at a meeting at which my attendance is required. So there's that. Then we'll have a normal Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then it gets weird again at the beginning of next week and throughout that week and the following week, the beginning of the week, because I'm going to be on the road doing some mountaintop removal-related stuff. More announcements coming, if anything, broadcast-worthy comes out of all that. So stay tuned, stay posted. At the top of the next hour, we're going to be having a little conversation with John Fox, the webmaster of The Horn, as well as host of All Foxed Up, technical guru, engineering genius, et cetera, about changes going on at the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com website. I mentioned them toward the end of last week. The redo of the website is in full swing. If you go and you look at the, I'm tickled to death with the new look of the page. I think it's going to be really much, much nicer, much more navigable, and make a heck of a lot more sense. So, John has been working like a man possessed on all of those things. So please be patient, bear with us, but it will be fully functional before you know what happened. Part of this was, well, the main reason was to have everything ready and just shiny as a new penny, both for our trip to Washington, D.C. for the America's Future Now conference in early June, and then more particularly our trip to Netroots Nation in the third week of July. Because we're an Internet-based radio network. Our first and best foot forward is our visual presence on said intertubes. Yeah, John's been pulling 16 to 20 hours a day since Friday. Yeah. I will admit to a little bit of recreation over the past weekend. Agnes and I marked our 17th Let's see. What is 17th anniversary? Is that Paperclip? No. It's Staple. No. It's the Essence of Lemon Pledge. No. But anyway, we passed our 17th wedding anniversary. As stunning to you as it probably is to me, or as probably as stunning to you as it actually is to me. I keep looking around. Wow, you keep hanging around. What did I ever do to deserve you? And I mean that in as nice a sense as is humanly possible, not in, you know, what did I do? No. I'm still a little bit blown away. But she's still here. And we spent a little bit of quality time together, and, well, it was just nice all the way around. So that was part of the weekend. But as the punchline of the joke says, coffee breaks over, back on our heads. And speaking of jokes, I wanted to start out with one of my favorite really terrible, terrible pun jokes. I love this one. I adore this one. You know the old saying, he who would pun would pick a pocket? Yeah. Well, I thought I was reminded of this earlier. And trust me, work with me here. I don't come out and take my wife, please, you know, funny guy monologue at the beginning of the program. But I was reminded of this by some weightier and considerably heavier matters. Not the least of which was the fact that, put it this way. An English dandy in the century before last, the late 19th century, shall we say, an English dandy was touring Australia. And it was getting along in the afternoon, and he was out in the bush, and the only thing nearby was a sheep station. Barely much more than a ramshackle the bunkhouse. But he stops there because it's getting on toward late in the afternoon. And he thought he'd like a cup of tea. The English dandy comes in and says, like a spoonful of tea, if you please. And the fellow there at the station says, right, what do you want? What do you have? And, the dandy says, well, I don't know. What sort do you purvey here? Well, the most popular thing around here is our koala. Hey, really? Well, do bring me a pot. So the dandy sits there and waits, and sure enough, the guy brings back a pot and cup, saucer, pours it, and lo and behold, there's all this stuff floating in it, there at the sheep station in the middle of the outback. The only sign over the thing just says Mercy in the middle of the bush, middle of nowhere. Little station called Mercy. And like I said, he pours the tea, and there's sticks and stems and leaves and little chunks of flowers or something all just floating in the tea. And the English dandy says, my good man, what is all of this flotsam, jetsam, floating in my tea? Thelma looks in and says, must have forgotten to mention. The koala tea of mercy is not strained. Love that one. Just love it. The koala tea of mercy is not strained. And I thought of that because of the line from The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare, which I was reminded of by the places that my mind was going earlier in the day today, for a variety of reasons. The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare, in which Portia speaks to Shylock about mercy itself. The The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the plates beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute of God himself, and earthly power doth then show like God's when mercy seasons justice. Why was I thinking about that? Because I've been thinking about some of the things that I've been thinking about and talking about. About wanting, for instance, Grover Norquist to be the point of the spear, with a plastic bucket standing out in the shallower reaches of the Gulf of Mexico, waiting for some of that free market crude to roll up on him so that all those free marketeers, those tea baggers, those babies, those dullards, those insensate fools who do not realize that we either all stand together or we all hang separately, can do their best with the oil slick that they helped cause. Indeed, indeed, indeed. And then I saw another news story later today from the Mobile Press Register. In it, officials in the state of Alabama are crying, "Lord, Lord!" As the book puts it, for that socialist in the White House to federalize the National Guard so that the federal government will be on the dime instead of the state of Alabama when the National Guard begins assisting in the cleanup effort or the prevention effort or whatever effort may be made to deal with the BP horror as it flows and oozes and shinnies toward that exquisite Gulf Coast of Alabama and Mississippi, North Florida, all places, all of them places that are absolutely chock-a-block full of rotten-ass teabagging babies, spoiled rat Randians, who've hollered, "I want to get the government out of my life. I don't want no government. I don't want no socialism. Get out of my life. Tax enough already." And I thought, you miserable bastards. You sorry sons of sea cooks. You want your state's rights, Alabama? Well, how's about you have your state's rights to pay your own damned way and pay for your own National Guard cleanup instead of crying, "Lord, Lord," to that federal government you so thoroughly despise? And then my thoughts moved northward. One meteorologist saying what happened in the Nashville area was something nigh akin to thousand-year floods. And when you're talking about thousand-year floods, you are talking about floods of a biblical proportion, because if you're a literalist about the Old Testament, as so many Southern fundamentalists are, the earth was scarcely 1,000 years old when Almighty, compassionate, and all-loving God decided he'd screwed up and he was going to start all over again, except for Noah. Right. and they sent a flood. Remember, you remember the Noah's Ark story with the grain supply rooms tucked into a cave that somehow have become Noah's Ark in a cave? Yeah, you know the story. It's BS. And I thought about the Gaylord Opryland Hotel. Underwater. Screwed. As is much of that lovely, lovely region. Because the Cumberland River escaped its banks in a big way. And I thought about the Gaylord Opryland Hotel, which actually played host to that vile, hate-filled, nasty-ass bagger fest a couple of months ago. And the first thing that came into my mind was, screw them too! Let the miserable, rotten-ass Randians get out and clean up the mess. They don't want no gummit. Taxed enough already. And I thought, screw them. I thought about baggers who had been at the Bagger Fest in Nashville that came after the Bagger Fest in Huntsville, Alabama, where they'd marched around with their little Mao, the Obama as Mao t-shirts, where that loopy-ass Victoria Jackson had sung "There's a Communist in the White House." And for a minute, just for a minute, I think I almost got in touch with